I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Back in 2018, Jason Kander had what many thought was a charmed life. He was running to be the next mayor of Kansas City, having already been a Missouri state representative and its secretary of state. It was as though the former army captain was born to serve. But the depression and post-traumatic stress disorder that followed him home from the war in Afghanistan stopped all that. Kander dropped out from public life to focus on his mental health. He emerged a year later, better, but not completely healed, and he still had a strong desire to serve. Today we find out what's driving Jason Kander these days and what he thinks of this most unusual year on Up to Date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. With Jason Kander, there's always so much to talk about, like the Veterans Community Project based here in Kansas City, tiny homes, his recently resurrected political podcast, his political future, and his own well-publicized struggles with PTSD. Then there's this latest news that Jason is under consideration to be President-elect Joe Biden's new Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Jason Kander made national news a couple of years back when he dropped out of the race for Kansas City mayor, citing his battle with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Until that moment, he was seen as the odds-on favorite to become the city's next mayor. Jason Kander is a former Missouri Secretary of State. He's a former state representative from Kansas City, and he joins us right now. Jason, nice to have you back. Welcome.
Always good to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me, man.
You know, you've had a whirlwind couple of years. So much going on. So I'm wondering, how are you?
I am really great, because actually it's in a way my life before the last couple of years was the whirlwind. And the last couple of years is when I got a chance to finally slow down and figure out what it is I want to do with my life. So I'm doing very well. We just had our second child.
Congratulations.
Daughter,
yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. So she's 2 months old, and you know, we're doing pretty well, all things considered.
And how's your health? Because maybe that's the most important thing of all here.
Best it's been in my, I almost would say in my adult life, but I guess wow. I was technically an adult before I went to Afghanistan. So, I really good. I mean, my mental health, my physical health, I think those two things are linked, and, I'm feeling really, really good. I mean, like everybody, every day is not perfect, but, I have entered a chapter of my life that I refer to as post-traumatic growth. And, And so I never miss the opportunity to tell anybody out there who, if things have not been right and not felt right for a while, go see somebody. It's no different than physical health, and it's worth it.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because it was October 2nd, 2018, when you told the community and the rest of the country, for that matter, that you were struggling with PTSD. You were struggling with depression as well. You said you were dealing with suicidal thoughts, even as you were raising more money than any mayoral candidate in Kansas City history. What have you been doing to deal with all that? How are you approaching all that?
So I went to the VA, and I went to a regimen of weekly therapy for several months. As an aside, the way that I was able to quickly get into weekly therapy at the VA is I got help with my paperwork from Veterans Community Project, which is a big part of how my relationship with the organization started. I had toured it as a candidate for mayor and just fallen in love with the place. And as you know, now I'm the president of Veterans Community Project. But so VCP, as we call it, played a big role in making sure that I got quick access to the services that I needed. And it made a huge difference for me. The PTSD clinic in Kansas City at the VA does a fantastic job. And, after several months, you're never cured, but what happens is you get to a point where the symptoms don't disrupt your life, and you know how to handle them. And so there was a lot of healing that went on. And so since then, my life has changed quite a lot from what it used to be. You know, I used to just basically live on airplanes, and I guess no one's doing that right now. But even before COVID, that part of my life had changed. I mean, to the point where now, you know, I'm the president of VCP. I have my podcast, like you mentioned, and I have other things I pursue. But I'm also, you know, I drop my son off at school every morning. I pick him up every afternoon. I coach his little league team. It's my life is right where I want it to be right now.
Huh. Is it still fair to say that life is a daily struggle, or I guess it is for all of us, but I think you know what I'm saying, or is that part of your life past you now?
You know, I would agree that everybody is struggling with something.
Right.
But the thing about post-traumatic stress is it's not unlike a physical injury, in that if you treat it, you can get a lot better. I mean, so to give you an analogy, before I went into the Army, I had to have knee surgery. And so if I'm a pretty good runner, I mean, I run pretty frequently, but when I hit about 3 miles, I start to feel it a little bit, and I know, okay, I gotta ice it. That's where my post-traumatic stress is at this point. Like, it's a part of my life, but it doesn't disrupt my life. I know the things I need to do to deal with it. I need to work out nearly every day. That really helps me. It's different for everybody. I get enough sleep. You know, there's just things that I do that, not unlike an old knee injury, just allow me to go about my life.
I've just got to say this. I'm still so impressed that you're willing to talk about this so openly. I think what a gift you're giving to so many people everywhere. What kind of feedback have you gotten about your willingness to be so open about this?
Well, thanks for saying that, Steve. I wish that every single person who decided to get help had the opportunity to receive the sort of affirmation that I have. I mean, obviously, when I made the decision to be public, I didn't know. I didn't know what I was jumping into. All I knew was that I was giving up the stuff that was going extremely well in my life in order to take a leap of faith that maybe I could get better. I didn't know if I could. And I tell everybody, like, we all live to some degree public lives, you know, with social media, and you're just on display anymore. And there's two reasons why it's helpful to be public with any battle like this you're in. And the first is that it will help you stay accountable. I mean, for me as a public person, by telling the world what I was really going through, it removed for me this feeling that I needed to put on any kind of face, which took some pressure off of me. It also put some pressure on me, right? Mm-hmm. But then the other thing that it did is what you're alluding to, which is I wish everybody had the opportunity to have so many people reach out to them and say, what you did caused me to get help and you saved my life. I've had people mm-hmm. tell me that. And the thing is, everybody can. Like, even if you're not on social media, if you just have six coworkers and you're dealing with something and you tell your six coworkers what you're going through, two things will happen. One, they'll be there for you more than you would expect. And two, of the six, there's a pretty decent chance three of them are dealing with something too. And they hadn't decided to get help and you might save their life. So it's been being able to be public about this has been, for me as a public person, an important part of it.
I'm visiting with Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State, about politics, the pandemic, and what's ahead for him. Jason, let's talk politics here. You took yourself out of the race for mayor in 2019. You just announced that you're not running for the U.S. Senate next year against Roy Blunt again. Are you done with politics?
You know, I don't know if I'm done. And first of all, let's break down the words in politics, right? Like, being in politics.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I was a surrogate for the Biden campaign. I was on the platform committee for the Democratic National Committee at the convention. I have one of the most popular political podcasts in the country, Majority 54. So I would say I'm pretty firmly in politics. I mean, I did. And I'm getting to, I promise, it's not the old me, Steve. I'm going to answer your question. This is a builder. Like, I'm not dodging the question. I'm just getting there. You know, I did, like, during the last few months of the campaign, I was via Zoom headlining fundraisers for candidates and causes across the country, you know, usually twice every night for the last 4 months. So I feel very much that I'm in politics to the extent that I want to be. Whether I end up on a ballot again, I have no idea. Right now, I don't have any desire to do that right now, because I just really enjoy what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I really like the work that I'm able to do, leading Veterans Community Project and expanding it across the country, that it very much to me is public service. And I'm also I have a young family and I'm enjoying my life very much. I get to exercise every day. I get to, as I said, I get to coach my son's little league team. So I don't know. Maybe one day I will. It's just not something I have a desire to do at the moment.
You know, why did you say no to the U.S. Senate this year? And maybe you've just answered it, but you came so close in 2016 against Roy Blunt, and who, if the stories are true, thought he was going to lose that election on election night. He thought he was done. What was your thinking this time around?
I mean, it's really simple. I just don't want to be a U.S. senator right now. Okay. I mean, I'm not trying to say there's anything wrong with it. It's like, you know, any job, when you consider changing your job, you just think about, well, the job you have now and the job you would pursue. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're running for office or doing something else. I'm the president of Veterans Community Project. I have the chance to build tiny houses for homeless vets across the country, to serve vets in so many different ways. And when I compare that to the prospect of running for and becoming a U.S. senator, I prefer what I'm doing now. And anytime I prefer what I'm doing now, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing.
Well, then, what about this idea of you becoming one of President-elect Biden's cabinet secretaries, Jason? You're being mentioned as a possible secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. What do you think? Because I'm getting the impression that maybe this isn't where you're going to go right now.
Well, look, the president-elect is putting together a great cabinet, and I'm really confident that he's going to put together a great group of people, and it's really flattering to be thought of for that sort of thing. I'd say, you know, I love what I'm doing, and I don't see it changing.
For a guy who just left the Missouri House of Representatives 7 years ago, how does it feel to be even mentioned for a presidential cabinet post?
Good. It's good. For me, it's like 2 years ago, I was getting ready to run for president, right? Or a little over 2 years ago. So I guess I don't know how to process any of that stuff, other than to try and keep it all in perspective and to remember that, like, all of these things are jobs and they are lifestyles and they are all consuming. And one of the advantages that I have is that I pretty much, as you know, pretty much ran for president. I did the whole dry run thing. So I've had the experiences of what all that is like, you know, being involved at that level, whether you're talking cabinet or candidate or whatever it is. So I don't hardly ever look at, you know, watch my friends who are still doing that stuff on TV and have like a fear of missing out. Mm-hmm. I sort of know what that life is like, and I had that experience, and perhaps one day, you know, Diana and I will decide to jump back onto that treadmill and do that again. But I have the benefit of that experience, and it's nice to know what that's like and to be able to make the choice of, I just really like what I'm doing. And, you know,
regardless of your level of interest in heading the Department of Veterans Affairs, what are the big issues facing that agency today? What needs fixing when it comes to America's veterans?
Well, I appreciate the question. A couple of things. One, I think most Americans don't realize that the federal government and most public benefits programs for veterans, they don't regard the veteran category the same way the rest of us do. Most of us, when we think of what a veteran is, we think of someone who wore the uniform of the country, served, you know, raised their right hand and signed that blank check up to and including their life. But actually, the people who fall into that category, 30 to 40% of them are not eligible for VA services, either because they didn't serve enough active duty or because of their discharge status or all sorts of different things. And so, you know, one of the biggest problems out there that really, really needs to be solved is widening the sight aperture, if you will, widening the scope of people who qualify for those services. And then second, is I think taking an approach that fills in a lot of the loopholes out there and just simplifies the process. I mean, I'll just use my own example.
Yeah, your own example is pretty illustrative here, right?
Right. I mean, and some of this has changed. The problem is most people don't know that a lot of these rules have changed. But in my case, this hadn't changed 2 years ago. The rule was that if you came in to the VA within 5 years of your combat deployment, then no questions asked, you could be enrolled in the system. Well, you know, in my case, like, I'd spent 11 years trying to convince myself that I didn't have post-traumatic stress, and also, like, therefore the world that I didn't have it. And now here I am, I'm 11 years out from my combat deployment. I am ready to say, okay, I've got post-traumatic stress. And as a symptom of that at the time, depression and all these other things. And I go in and I pretty much find out that because I'm outside the 5-year window, I have to basically prove like a legal case that I have this thing that I've been telling myself I didn't have for all these years. And there's a lot of problems with that. One of which is trauma is not wine. It doesn't get better with age. It gets worse. Hmm. And so that's just one example. And here I was like, phone full of influential contacts, law degree, high level government experience. And I needed Veterans Community Project to help me, you know, get into the system.
And welcome back. Jason Kander is my guest today. He's a former state representative from Kansas City, a former Secretary of State of the state of Missouri. He's now deeply involved in a podcast and in veterans issues here in town. Jason, what did you, you mentioned you're still working with the Veterans Community Project that's well known for its tiny homes village. The project also has unveiled an ambitious plan for a new $10 million campus expansion at 89th and Troost. How's the fundraising going? Why do you need the expansion?
It's going really well. Thanks for asking. And we're really excited about this expansion. So as you know, Steve, my focus at VCP is on the national expansion of our model, and that's going really well. We've announced recently we're coming to St. Louis. We've broken ground in Colorado. We got a bunch of other cities that we're probably going to announce in the next year. And what is so cool about that is that Kansas City has really led the way with this model. And now the expansion in Kansas City is to expand, our services here, which eventually we will probably expand that out as well. So what we're doing is we're creating a navigation campus for veterans that really is something that is needed in every city across the country, but it will be a hub for all veteran services. So right now, well, actually, let me put it this way. When you're in the service, one of the most difficult parts of the transition out of the service is you go from when you're in the service, you know, the place where you go to, get a dental checkup and the place where you go to check to make sure that you're still getting paid, the finance office, they are frequently in the same building, if not, across the street from one another. So you get really used to the idea that things work a certain way and you don't have to, figure all sorts of crazy things out, insurance and all this other stuff that it's one of the many difficulties of adjusting to civilian life. And so what this will do is it will take all this, different smorgasbord, hodgepodge of different veteran services, every possible thing that a veteran could need, and bring them under one roof and create a continuum so that you can go to one place and you can get everything you need. You can keep going to that same place. And so that's the idea. And so Veterans Community Project will be the hub for every possible service that a veteran could need. And then once we've made that successful here in Kansas City, and we're already starting to do a lot of this, this is about creating the facility to expand it, then I fully anticipate that our expansion cities will probably covet one of these as well.
Huh. What does it say about the VA, Jason, that there's a need for these navigation centers, as you call it?
Well, the VA, first of all, will be represented at our location, and they're very excited about it. But look, before I say something critical of the VA, let me say this, which is that every single person, just as a patient myself, every single person that I have met at the VA, from the clinicians to the person, on the call center line, I mean, everybody has clearly taken a lot of pride in the fact that they serve veterans. And it is across the board been one of the best customer service experiences I've ever had in terms of just the approach of the individuals. But yes, the system as it's designed in Washington and the limitations put on it by funding and by all sorts of decisions by politicians usually at the top, really limits what they can do. We get a fair amount of people for all of our services. We get a fair amount of people referred to us by the VA who will say, hey, this person needs this. We can't provide it to them because they're limited in their eligibility for our services, and they'll send them to us. And I'll tell you, recently when we were dedicating the land in St. Louis for where our location is going to be there, we did this big ceremony. And then afterwards, we had all of, and it's in an area not unlike the area where we have built in Kansas City. There's a fair amount of homeless people who live in that area. And a bunch of homeless vets started gravitating toward us after the ceremony was over. And the first question was, is this a VA thing? And as soon as we said, no, it's not VA, it's privately funded and your discharge status, all that stuff doesn't matter. Then they just sort of lit up and they're like, okay, well, how soon is this going to be built? So, It is a, we it's a problem that the VA is viewed with that skepticism by a lot of veterans, but it's why our role is so important, because it enhances our credibility with veterans that they know, like, we're not going to get disqualified for the from these services.
You know, the Veterans Community Project is also involved with these tiny homes that have become great homes for veterans for a number of years now. And the homes actually are pretty tiny. How many of them do you have?
So there's 49 of them in Kansas City. We are building a 25-house village in Longmont, Colorado, just outside of Denver. We're going to build a 50-house village in St. Louis. And then, you know, we've got announcements that will come in the next year for additional ones. What's really important about the homes, though, is that they come with wraparound comprehensive case management services, which is why our system is so successful.
How much time do you spend out there at 89th and Troost?
Well, it's my day job. You know, that's my full-time job. But like anybody else, I'm doing a lot of working from home right now. But when I go to the office, that's where I go.
I've had the sense for a while now that maybe this is going to be your life's work.
Yeah, I think that's not wrong in some regard or another. But I could certainly see myself being at VCP until I retire. It's not something that I would think is out of the question at all. Look, these wars, for better or worse, have really defined my life in a lot of ways, and the opportunity to be a part of helping American soldiers and service members literally come home safely, that's really all I ever wanted to do, including when I was in. And so it's a big part of who I am.
Different topic. I just got a minute left here in this segment. What did you make of the outcome of the presidential election?
I was pleased.
I'm stunned. Yeah.
You know, look, it's not a surprise to me that it was, first of all, it was not a close race. It was a pretty big win by the president-elect. But it was not at all surprising to me that there were still plenty of people out there voting for an incumbent president. It's very difficult to beat an incumbent president.
Right.
And so the reason that I have my podcast Majority 54 is because I'm a big believer in the fact that, you know, my side, the progressive side, is the majority. But if we're going to effectively bring the country back together, and we're going for in the long term and actually being able to govern this country, we all have a responsibility, particularly here in places like Kansas City and in the Midwest, to reach out to the people in our lives who don't currently exist in that majority and aren't for these progressive values, and to do it in a way that's productive and doesn't lose those relationships. So this election just drove that home for me, that if we're going to actually accomplish things in this country, not just win the election, we got a lot of work to do to bring people around.
And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. I'm visiting today with Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State and 2016 U.S. Senate candidate. Jason, you wrote a column for The Star not long ago talking about how members of the military largely did not back President Trump for re-election. That might surprise some people. Why not?
Well, because we tend to know leadership when we see it. And one of the things I wanted to establish in that is that because this is one of the biggest things people ask me in particular about politics, is they'll say, well, why are the troops so frequently Republican? Why are there more Republicans in active duty? And what I always try to remind people, and I started that column by reminding people, is that if you took any workplace in the United States and you said, okay, this is a place where 4 out of 5 people who work here are men, and it is disproportionately drawn, the workers are disproportionately drawn from the South and the Midwest, I would say, well, that is a workplace where the majority of people are probably Republicans, because that's what those demographics match up to. And that's what's going on with the military. So it means that much more when you have polls before the election that said that the majority of active duty troops were voting for Vice President Biden. And the reason for it is that from the very beginning of the administration, we saw President Trump treat the military as a prop, you know, literally, like, I want to have parades just to honor me, you know, that sort of approach. And then saying things, you don't even have to get into the stuff that's disputed about whether he said it. Like, forget the stuff about suckers and losers. Like, even if you don't believe that stuff, this is a guy who within days of coming into office ordered a raid over dinner solely because President President Obama had said no to the raid. And then when a Navy SEAL, Ryan Owens, was killed in that raid, what did the president do? He blamed the generals. And anytime something went well, it was his responsibility. Right. And that's just not what we learn in the military. And so I think what happened there is that a lot of people who come from Republican ancestral roots back home said, you know, I don't agree with the vice president on a lot of stuff because I was raised politically different than him. But I think we need real leadership. And I think that just shows what a poor job President Trump has done and what a good job people think President like Biden will do. And by the way, it's not a small thing that the Bidens will be the first military family to be the first family since the Eisenhowers.
Interesting. So, yeah. As a former Secretary of State and Chief Elections Officer in Missouri, Jason, is there any question in your mind that the election was conducted fairly?
No. In fact, I think one of the saddest parts of this completely bogus campaign that the president and much of his side of the aisle is running to try and discredit this election solely because they lost it. One of the saddest parts of that is we are missing the opportunity to celebrate the fact that we did a really special thing as America. You know, we take great pride in our democracy. And during a pandemic, we held an election where we had the highest turnout we've had in a long time. And we did it there's like pretty much no cases of fraud at all. And most of the ones that do exist are what usually happens, which is accidents and irregularities. So I think it's a real shame that because the president can't take the L, we are missing the opportunity to actually be proud of ourselves as a country for doing something pretty special.
Tell us about your political podcast, Majority 54. You mentioned it a few minutes ago. And why is it called Majority 54?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking, Steve. I appreciate it. So we originally named it Majority 54 back when we started it in 2017, because the idea at the time was to remind people that the majority, 54% of Americans, voted for somebody not named Donald Trump for president. And the idea behind it, which is still the theme, was to allow people to have conversations with their conservative or independent relatives and coworkers and friends. About politics and bring them over to their side without alienating them. Because one of the, at the time that we started it, I was traveling around the country. And one of the most common questions I got was some version of, I love my aunt, I love my brother-in-law, I love my cousin, but they're saying all these things. And when we try and discuss these things, like it's pushing us apart. And there's a lot of people listening to this right now who have lost relationships they care about because of the last 4 years politically. And so we do something that, really no other podcast or media effort in the country does, which is our objective is to help people persuade the people in their lives without losing those relationships. And I argue that that is more important than any political ad, more important than any messaging that a campaign could do, because if you have a cousin who, voted differently than you and views the world differently than you, you have the best chance of turning their heart and changing their mind of anybody. It's not going to be something they see on the news. It's not going to be, anything like that. It's going to be somebody who they have a relationship with and they love and they trust and who has credibility with them, who says, here's why I feel the way I do. And so what we do is we arm people with the strategy and the information and the stories that they need to make that case without losing those relationships.
You're also writing a book. What's it about?
It is about my experience, living through the struggle of untreated, undiagnosed post-traumatic stress, and most importantly, the battle to recover, and now what my life is like in post-traumatic growth. And as we talked about a few minutes ago, one of the most important things I can do in public life for the rest of my life is model that. I mean, the thing is I think one of the reasons that it took me and so many other people so long to get help is that if you look at portrayals of post-traumatic stress, whether fiction or nonfiction in the media, whether you're on screen or just in the news, most of the portrayals are of people who are battling it. There are very few portrayals of people who have fought it and gotten better. And the thing is, like, if you look at the studies, well over half the people who decide to treat it and who commit to the program get better and experience post-traumatic growth. And there's very few examples out there for people. And so I know it was important that I was, as a public person, I said, I'm going to go get help. But I think it is just as important that I sort of help people like lead the way to, you can get better. It is worth it.
Jason, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. We wish you the best in your recovery, wishing you the best with the book and the podcast. And thanks so much for your time today. We sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve, for your friendship, man, and for the show. I really appreciate it. Good to talk to you.
You bet, Jason.